From Minnesota to Alabama, Texas to Maine, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a package of bills designed to protect worker rights has been introduced in the U.S. Senate. Vincent Vernuccio from the Institute for the American Worker is here with details. A challenge to the Texas Congressional Redistricting Plan is headed to the Supreme Court of the United States. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. President Donald Trump has proposed using tariff revenue to give a check for $2,000 to most Americans. But is that fiscally sound? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has the answer. And conservatives were advised by William F. Buckley Jr. to stand athwart history yelling stop. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Keith Rothfuss says it is still necessary to do that. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The rights of individual workers would gain significant protections if a package of bills now before the U.S. Senate becomes law. To learn more, we turn to Vincent Vernuccio. He is president of the Institute for the American Worker. Vinny, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Vinny, the so-called HELP, H-E-L-P, package of bills aimed to buttress the rights of American workers. Tell us a bit about HELP and what all is encompassed in that legislation.
First, thank you for having me on. Chairman Cassidy and the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee package to empower workers. And it includes multiple bills that deal with guaranteeing worker enfranchisement, protecting the right to the secret ballot, making sure that workers have a say in if they're supporting union politics or not, that the board that administers union elections and many labor laws is actually following the law themselves, protecting worker privacy, and a whole host of other good things.
So we have all of those things in this legislation. Does this provide any protections to workers? I know in a number of states we have right-to-work laws, which means that an employee is not required to be a member of a labor union in order to have a job. But in a number of states, there are not protections that, for example, union dues can be used for political purposes. Does this proposed package of bills, does it address any of those issues?
It actually does. So it is not just one bill, but it's a package. So there's multiple bills, four from Senator Cassidy, one from Senator Tuberville, Senator Scott, Senator Banks. The one you are talking about, this is encapsulated in one of the bills. It's the Worker Results Act that guarantees the secret ballot. It also guarantees that workers get a quorum before the union has a monopoly on representing all of the workers at a workplace. And then others actually protect what you're talking about, the political. So this would be Cassidy's Union Members' Right to Know Act, which informs workers of their rights and the rights not to fund union politics. And it also gives them an annual opportunity to opt in to funding union politics, as opposed to the default now, which is it's an arduous opt-out system, especially in states where unions can get workers fired for not paying them, so non-right-to-work states, where they have to jump through a lot of hoops to opt out. And once, but on the other hand, once they're in forever. So that opt-in on an annual basis is a big jump for protecting workers and their ability to choose whether or not to fund union politics.
When you use the term secret ballot, where does that come into play?
Right now, there's two ways that a union can organize. They can go out, they can get cards, and if they get a card from roughly a third of workers, they can present that petition or those cards to an employer and say, let's have an election. Now, generally, they'll get 70-80% because they want to know that, you know, they'll probably win that election, because obviously people will sign these petitions or these cards, and then, you know, when they have the privacy of a voting booth and no one looking over their shoulder, they may vote the other way. The other problem with these cards is they can be obtained by deception or coercion. It's very unreliable. So this is why that secret ballot is so important.
But unfortunately, the other way that unions could organize today is by getting 50% plus one of those cards, going to an employer and say, recognize us. And then the employer just says, sure, and then those workers are organized without ever having an election. And then it even gets worse because the National Labor Relations Board, that board that we were just talking about under the Biden administration, went a step further and said, well, even if workers do have an election, and then the union says the employer did something bad, that employer is then guilty until they prove they're innocent, and if they don't, the NLRB could actually throw out the election, even if workers said, we don't want this union, and allow the union to come in and give them a monopoly to organize them anyway. So when we're talking about the secret ballot, we're talking about protecting workers' right to choose their union, just like we choose the president, governor, Congress, state legislator, having that vote in a secret ballot without someone looking over your shoulder.
Another piece of legislation that is working its way through Congress, the Employee Rights Act. Tell us a bit about that.
This is another legislation that was introduced in the Senate before Senator Cassidy's package. It was introduced by Senator Scott. And over the summer, it was first introduced this year by Representative Allen. And it is the most comprehensive pro-worker bill in Congress today. A lot of the great provisions we were just talking about in that Senate help package are encapsulated in the Employee Rights Act. It has that guarantee of a secret ballot election. It has those political protections, that opt-in. It has protecting employee privacy, so employees get to choose what information is given to unions when unions are trying to organize them. It has protections for small business, saying that their employees should be considered their employees and not employees of a distant corporation. It also protects the rights of workers to be independent contractors, to work for themselves, making it a more sane definition. In right-to-work states, it also protects workers' ability to negotiate directly with their employer, something that is unfortunately forbidden right now. Even with right-to-work laws, workers can stop paying the union, but they're still stuck under that union contract, whether they want to be or not. It also has other protections, such as making sure that unions, which are taking away a union's unfortunate exemption from the RICO statute, if a union is doing something, quote, in furtherance of a legitimate labor objective, according to the Supreme Court, they can be exempt from the federal RICO statute, and the Employee Rights Act takes away that exemption. It's called the Freedom from Union Violence Act, which is incorporated in the ERA and several other provisions as well.
Benny, tell us a little bit about the Institute for the American Worker.
We've got all of the information on this package, on the Employee Rights Act, and several other pieces of legislation, both the House and the Senate, on our website. It's on our pro-worker agenda at i4aw.org, i4aw.org. And here at Institute for the American, we believe in the individual worker. We want to see modern labor policy for a modern workforce and policies that empower workers across the country to work with who they want and how they want in a way that is best for them and their families.
Vinnie Vernuccio, president of the Institute for the American Worker. Vinnie, thank you for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He keeps an eye on what's happening in Congress, also key developments politically and otherwise around the country. Scott's back with us again today. Scott, good to have you here.
Thank you, Loman. It's my pleasure.
In the state of Texas, the Lone Star State, there has been a redistricting of congressional maps, a major development this past week. Can you give us the details?
You got to go back to the spring when the Texas legislature worked with Governor Abbott to draw new congressional lines and effectively give us the opportunity to pick up as much as five congressional seats in the 2026 midterms. The big problem for this week in Texas is that a federal court blocked Texas's new congressional maps, ruling that they were illegal racial gerrymandering that would harm Black and Hispanic residents. And so they're saying through this lower court that they can't be used in the 2026 elections. Well, we've already got dozens and dozens of candidates that have been filing in Texas all across the state, including in these competitive races that are new. And the filing deadline is December 8th. So I think that Texas is going to have a quick decision here. It's been appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. The initial court ruling was 2-1. And since there were only three people with that lower court, it doesn't go to the Circuit Court of Appeals in the Fifth. It actually goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so I think that we should expect the Supreme Court to rule here shortly, hopefully within the next 10 days or so. Otherwise, we're going to have a big scramble for sort of congressional musical chairs is what I would call it. You know, obviously, we've had a lot of retirements in Texas. There's several Republican incumbents that have decided to hang it up, and those are big Republican seats. We had Jody Arrington, the chairman of the House Budget Committee. He recently announced that he wouldn't seek re-election. You've got people like Michael McCaul, a chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the past. He's hanging it up. Chip Roy is running for attorney general in Texas. And we've also got competitive races against people like Dan Crenshaw and Tony Gonzalez, a couple of incumbents. But then you've got these five other big open races and just a lot of candidates that are watching the Supreme Court very closely. Now, obviously, if the Supreme Court says no, the state legislatures and the Constitution are supposed to be able to handle the redistricting efforts in states. It's going to, I think, give many, many other states the precedent through the Supreme Court where they can do gerrymandering in any fashion that they basically choose based on partisan breakdown and not having to hold these districts for any minority class. So it's going to be, I think, a really fascinating thing for a lot of electoral insiders watching what the Supreme Court decides and how that impacts Texas, not just over the next 10 days or before December 7th, but obviously then they've got their primary election in March, and the runoff election for the primary will be in May.
And, of course, this doesn't just impact Texas, does it? Are there a number of not only Republican states, but also the state of California considering redistricting? So we could have wide-ranging consequences here?
Absolutely. I think the question is, how does the Supreme Court rule here? And then will there be lawsuits filed in other states to either push redistricting forward because a state might have racial discrimination within their gerrymandering? Or whether or not they're just going to reverse the latest redistricting efforts that a state has taken on.
Let's go south now to the Sunshine State, Scott. A corruption scandal seems to have overtaken a member of Congress from that state. Who are we talking about, and what is it that she's accused of doing?
Well, she's not just accused. She was formally indicted. And we've got Congresswoman Sheila Sherfillis McCormick from Florida, a Democrat, has been charged for allegedly stealing about $5 million in disaster relief funds and using some of those funds to make illegal campaign contributions. This was an indictment by a Miami grand jury, and you know, obviously the Department of Justice is watching that very closely, but according to the indictment, she conspired to steal $5 million from FEMA along with her brother. And prosecutors are alleging that she routed these funds through a bunch of different accounts to disguise the source and that they were used in her 2021 congressional campaign or for her personal benefit. And she came in a special election following the death of Alcee Hastings. You and I talked about this race way back in 2021 pretty briefly, but she could face up to 53 years in prison if she's convicted. And this is not just some minimal charge. I think this is incredibly serious. You've got folks all over the political spectrum calling for her to resign. Even Congressman Greg Stube, a Republican from Florida, is filing a privileged motion to censure Sherfillis McCormick and remove her from all of her committees. You've got others that are calling for her to resign altogether. This is an abuse of public trust. $5 million is pretty significant. And part of how they revealed this, her income, her salary, went up by $5 million in 2021 compared to the previous year. And this has been an investigation that I think is obviously now resulting in an indictment, but it's something that I think has been ongoing for a couple of years.
Particularly reprehensible in a state like Florida, which is, as we know, periodically hit by severe hurricanes and depends on FEMA money to get people back on their feet. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a bit about the club, please.
Well, Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We also have Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action. If you want to learn about the races that we're following and getting involved in for 2026, visit us at clubforgrowth.org. And you can actually sign up and join to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
A proposed $2,000 payment to all but the highest income earners would have some unintended consequences. We learn more from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
President Donald Trump says that he wants to deliver $2,000 tariff rebate checks to American households to help offset higher prices throughout the economy and make everyday items more affordable. Is this a good idea or just the latest bit of fiscal fantasy to emanate from the White House? Let's dig into it. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. So I talked about this tariff rebate check idea a couple of weeks ago when it was not the president, but it was a member of the Senate, Senator Josh Hawley, who was proposing this. At the time, Hawley was talking about a $600 tariff rebate for middle and lower income households. And of course, his proposal was a bill that would have to go through Congress. Trump, of course, is aiming bigger and unclear whether he would actually need congressional authorization for this. In a post 2 weeks ago on Truth Social, the president said that he wanted $2,000 stimulus checks or tariff rebate checks that would be funded out of the revenues that the tariffs are bringing in. The whole thing seemed to be prompted by the fact that Democrats did quite well in elections earlier this month in New Jersey and New York City and Virginia, and they did so in large part by pushing a message based on affordability. Yes, it seems like voting with your wallet is back in vogue once again, or maybe it never really stopped being there. This also comes at a time when polls are increasingly showing that Americans are frustrated by the tariffs and by rising inflation. I just saw a YouGov economist poll this week that said 73% of Americans believe the tariffs are directly raising prices. That's obviously a big number that is a political problem for the president. Inflation has ticked up recently too, back up to 3% after it had fallen down into the mid 2% range during the first half of the year. So all of this, with all of this going on, it's understandable that the White House would be trying to find a way to address those concerns and a way to make literally just groceries more affordable. But that doesn't mean that these tariff rebate checks are a good idea. In fact, I think they are, frankly, a quite unserious idea for three reasons, sort of three and a half reasons. We'll go through them here in order. First, we got to do a little bit of math on this. Now, after delivering the rebate checks, Trump says that the remaining tariff revenue, what's left over, will be used to pay down the national debt. That's what he argued in that same Truth Social post on Monday. But the math here doesn't really work out in Trump's favor. Now, it's unclear exactly who would qualify for these stimulus checks. The proposal is not finalized yet, but Erica York at the Tax Foundation estimates that sending $2,000 checks to everyone who earns less than $100,000 annually would cost about $300 billion. That's a one-time cost of $300 billion. And if the income cutoff is higher, that means the total cost would grow if you give checks to upper middle class Americans too, people making maybe up to $150,000, then you're talking not $300 billion, but more as the price tag. If you're going to include children or other dependents in that amount, then the cost would grow again. So we should regard that $300 billion as a conservative estimate here when we're talking about how much this idea would cost. Meanwhile, Trump's tariffs are expected to generate between $183 billion and $228 billion this year. That's according to a pair of estimates by the Yale Budget Lab. The numbers are different because it just depends what sort of assumptions you take into account, whether you use so-called dynamic scoring or whether you're just looking at the revenues that come in a more standard way. But those two numbers, again, between $183 billion and $228 billion, the price tag for these tariff rebate checks would be around $300 billion. So you can do that math yourself. The stimulus checks would end up costing more than what the tariffs are going to bring in over the course of the next 12 months. And then that creates another problem. Remember that Trump said that he would use the leftover tariff revenue to pay down the national debt to help ease inflation. But as we just covered, there's not going to be any leftover revenue because you're going to need to spend more money on the checks than the tariffs bring in. The checks will actually add to the deficit instead. The third reason why I think this is a problem is that we should ask how many times the Trump administration is planning to spend the same dollar. Because back in the summer when the One Big Beautiful Bill passed Congress, that bill assumed that future tariff revenues would be part of an offset to pay for the extension of the Trump tax cuts. You can't spend the same dollar twice, but the Trump administration is now saying it will use the same bucket of tariff revenue to offset tax cuts, to fund stimulus checks, and to pay down the national debt. This is the kind of fiscal nonsense that got the country into massive debt, not the sort of thing that will get it out. There's also one additional problem, which is that a $300 billion stimulus plan would risk kicking off higher inflation once again. Numerous studies at this point have found that it was the stimulus checks sent during the COVID-19 pandemic that contributed to the surge of inflation during 2022 and 2023. They weren't the sole reason why inflation went as high as it's been in 40 years, but they were a contributing factor. And it is the lingering effects of that inflationary period that Trump is now trying to address. This is a political problem as well as an economic one, but promising another round of stimulus will risk repeating the same mistake. Now, at least some administration officials seem to realize as much. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Kevin Hassett, the director of the National Economic Council, have both thrown at least small buckets of tepid water on this idea. They've suggested that the stimulus checks maybe are not necessarily going to happen. But Trump tends to get what Trump wants at the end of the day, regardless of how nonsensical or whether the math adds up. And if that's the case here, if the president succeeds at just nakedly buying some temporary good feelings by throwing money around, that's not actually going to fix the underlying problems here. And worse, it risks blowing another hole in the federal government's leaky finances. For me, look, would I love an extra $2,000? Sure, absolutely. Who wouldn't? But this is an idea that just comes with too many risks. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out our coverage of everything going on in Washington, D.C. and around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Standing athwart history, yelling stop has been the battle cry of the conservative movement for decades. Doing so is still necessary. Former Congressman Keith Raffis explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
This week, the pioneer conservative publication, National Review, turned 70. On November 19, 1955, National Review founder William F. Buckley Jr. published a launching statement that included its famous raison d'etre to, quote, stand athwart history, yelling stop, at a time when no one is inclined to do so. National Review's platinum anniversary offers an opportunity to revisit Buckley's convictions and assess where the country and conservative movement stand today. In 1955, Buckley wrote, instead of covetously consolidating its premises, the United States seems tormented by its tradition of fixed postulates, having to do with the meaning of existence, with the relationship of the state to the individual, of the individual to his neighbor, so clearly enunciated in the enabling documents of our republic. Today in 2025, as we approach the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, Buckley's insight seems even sharper. Only 5 years ago, the George Floyd riots convulsed the nation. The seeds for that unrest were sown by critical race theory, which reached a high watermark in the New York Times' 1619 Project. America's internal detractors had moved from torment to contempt for its founding. Meanwhile, the party of Lincoln, who in the 1840s and 1850s revived the proper understanding of our enabling documents, revealed its own torment when its 2024 platform downplayed the urgency of defending our first inalienable right, the right to life. The inter-party state of play echoes William Butler Yeats's, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." In 1955, Buckley wrote, "The inroads that relativism has made on the American soul are not so easily evident. Today in 2025, we can see that Buckley identified this trend during the halcyon days of post-war America. The nuclear family was ascendant, moving to the suburbs while a baby boom took root. TV shows like Ozzy and Harriet reinforced these norms, and relativism seemed distant. But Buckley saw what was brewing in academia. Today, relativism's wreckage is indeed easily evident for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, especially when considering the educational, financial, mental, and physical well-being of those not raised in a stable two-parent household." In 1955, Buckley noted that the profound crisis of our era is, in essence, the conflict between the social engineers who seek to adjust mankind to conform with scientific utopias and the disciples of truth, who defend the organic moral order. "We believe that truth is neither arrived at nor illuminated by monitoring election results, binding though these are for other purposes, but by other means, including a study of human experience." Today, Buckley's defense of truth over the relativism endemic in utopian social engineering marks a core philosophical divide between conservatives and liberals. This fracture goes back to Eden, when mankind seized the power to define its own reality and its own determination of what is right and what is wrong. In that sense, Adam and Eve themselves could have authored what Justice Scalia called the, quote, "sweet mystery of life" passage in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992. Without transcendent truth, everything becomes malleable. Doubt me? Just ask a recent Supreme Court nominee to define a woman. Conservatives find themselves in the same battle we were in 70 years ago, if not millennia ago. The left hasn't moderated a bit since National Review launched. It has actually grown more determined. Although the Soviet Union's collapse exposed socialism's bankruptcy, the left just marches on. The right, on the other hand, has oscillated. With the exception of the promise of the Reagan era, it would seem the right is regressing to the state of play in the 1950s. Having been unable to repeal and replace Obamacare a decade ago, today's GOP fights over the extension of Obamacare's inflated taxpayer subsidies. Moreover, the irresponsible levels of spending and debt are a reminder of how far we have to go. The same goes for stalled momentum on social issues. For conservatives, that means there are plenty of opportunities to continue yelling stop, including, for starters, when government fails to prevent the bankruptcy of unreformed social programs, when government ignores threats to life and its dignity through abortion, genetically engineered embryos, and an unregulated IVF industry that creates throwaway embryos, and when political parties allow the mainstreaming of anti-Semitic antagonists. Come on, conservatives, let's hear those voices. I'm Keith Rothfuss for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WEJZ-FM and WGNE-FM in Jacksonville, Florida, along with KSOK-AM in Arkansas City, Kansas. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.